Introduction, come recap of what we've done so far. So, well, just say a sentence about Tantric Buddhism, which was a phase of Buddhism, sort of later phase of Buddhism, that is very concerned with a direct experience and also makes use of a lot of signs and symbols that kind of speak to us directly, not sort of mediated by concepts. And in the past couple of weeks, Jnanavacha's been reminding us something that Sangharakshita talks says about symbols. He says a symbol is different from a sign. A sign is has just got one meaning, like a sign sort of directly maps onto a concept. So like a road sign or something that's just got one meaning. But a symbol has got a whole spectrum of meanings. And the meanings of a symbol sort of reveal themselves to us over time as well. That's what I find quite interesting about symbols. And that's why I think it's always worth just following up any sort of sense of attraction we might feel to a particular symbol. So I was thinking about these hangings here. They've got lotuses on them. So a lotus is it's a very typical Buddhist symbol. And, you know, it might not mean anything to you, but on the other hand, you might just notice yourself then catching your eye, and you might find yourself, if you feel a bit attracted, say, to a symbol like a lotus or anything else, it's worth just dwelling on it. And then I found in my own experience something a bit, it almost feels like a bit magical happens, that over time, even over years, you start to realise more and more connections. You think, that's why I was drawn to the lotus, because the lotus, it comes out of the mud, you know, and we all come out of the mud as well. Or you think, and the petals are completely, they're completely pure. I think this is literally true of a lotus, that nothing sticks to it, but mud and stuff like that just sort of falls off it. So, you know, you might over time realise why oneself has been drawn to a particular symbol. And some symbols are universal, like the sun and the moon. And some symbols are particular to different cultures. So a lot of the symbols we have here at this Buddhist centre, for many, probably most of us, about 95% of us, won't be familiar with symbols. So we'll have to, if we want to, sort of investigate them more. But I don't mean investigate them with our sort of intellect, but they won't be, they might be a bit foreign to us at first, but it's worth kind of, I find for myself it's worth, it's just worth exploring the symbols of Buddhism in particular more. And that's what we're going to be exploring for it's a good long series, this. I think it's about eight or nine in the series, the symbols of Tantric Buddhism. And we're spending 3 or 4 weeks on one particular symbol, which is the Wheel of Life. This is a picture of it on the shrine. By rights, it shouldn't really be on the shrine, because what it's a symbol for is unenlightenment. So a shrine is a symbol of enlightenment. When we bow to the shrine, we're bowing to the Buddha as an enlightened being, and also our potential for enlightenment. So in a sense, the Wheel of Life isn't something we bow to, but I've just put it there so you can see it, basically. And I've got some pictures I'll give you of the Wheel of Life in the second half. Some of you might have them already. If you actually do bring them in with you, if you've got your picture of the Wheel of Life in the second half. So even if you can't see it closely, even from a distance, you can see this is a very, very colourful and very, very rich symbol, and there's loads and loads in it. You could explore it for years and years. But we're just talking about a few particular things. So one thing that you'll notice, even from a distance, is that this whole wheel is held by a monster, and that's the monster of impermanence. And I'll just say a little bit about that, because the monster of impermanence holds the wheel of life, and the wheel of life is a symbol of unenlightenment. And what that itself symbolises is that to the unenlightened mind, impermanence is frightening, is terrifying and monstrous. That's not the case for the enlightened mind. The enlightened mind, at enlightenment, the monster disappears. You realise there was no monster, because there was nothing. You can only, in a way, have a monster if there's something to terrify. A monster, and actually at enlightenment you realise, well, there's nothing there to be terrified. So in a way, the monster ceases to exist. So as unenlightened, impermanence, especially in the form of death, our own death, the death of people we love, the prospect of that, the actuality of that is horrible and terrifying and frightening. And it has us in its clutches. So the unenlightened mind is held in the clutches of the terror of impermanence. So that's outside. So we've said a little bit about the hub of the wheel. So at the hub of the wheel are three animals, the pig, cock and snake, and they represent greed, hatred and delusion. And that's what drives the wheel. So this thing's in motion. It's not just a picture of a circle. It's an actual wheel that's moving, that's going round and round, yeah? And the nature of a wheel is it's repetitive. It just keeps going round and round. And it digs ruts. So it kind of it digs grooves for itself. So it's that's what we do. That's what we do when we're unenlightened. It's not a sort of static thing. We actually kind of dig ourselves deeper and deeper into patterns and habits that aren't helpful. And Sangharaksha often talks about, in contrast to the wheel, the symbol of the spiral. So this, and it's like they're both modes of being. So the wheel is the circular, repetitive, digging ruts mode of being. The spiral is a mode of being that's starting to become free from that. So the wheel represents what Bhante calls the reactive mind that just reacts, has got no freedom of choice, just reacts. Whereas the spiral is the mode of being, the mode of mind that is creative, that realises there's a choice, that realises that it's possible to make creative choices. I really like the image of the spiral, because it's still kind of got a sense of that going round and round in it. So if you imagine now it's in a plane like that, the wheel's kind of flat like this maybe. If that's the wheel, sort of flat on this plane, you can imagine the spiral as kind of still going round and round, but kind of going more upwards. So it's starting to free itself from that just going round and round. And I think, well, life's like that, isn't it? We begin to free ourselves if we're practicing meditation and practicing the Dharma. We begin to see that we have got more perspective, there is more choice. But you're kind of still going round and round a bit, aren't you? Do people notice that? That even if you've been practicing, you still think, oh God, I'm here again. You know, you still feel, you do revisit the familiar old habits and patterns, but hopefully you revisit them with a bit more perspective. You don't get so completely just feeling like there's no way out. You know, you start to see there's a bit more perspective. So I quite like that it's a spiral. It's not just a ladder, you know, straight up, because it gives a sense of you do revisit. So So I think that's, it's just good to remember this in general. I'll just say another few minutes more about this before tea. So the reactive, the wheel is a reactive state. Yeah, so the wheel is representing us. And a reactive state of constantly circling back on ourselves, yeah. Whereas in the creative state, we feel more free and open and expansive and flowing. Sometimes we talk about the ego or the non-ego, don't we? But in a sense, it's not that there's this thing called the ego that's kind of expanding or contracting. It's not that there's a thing that's either in this this expansive or contractive state. It's more that being egoistic actually consists of the contraction of our being around a delusion, that delusion that's at the core. And being non-egoistic is a mode of being that doesn't feed or reinforce that delusion. Yeah, so it's starting to be free. So you could say that behaving in a non-egoistic way means orbiting around something bigger than yourself. Acting in an egoistic way means you're just in this tight, ever-tightening circle of self, yeah? But a non-egoistic way, you're orbiting around something that's bigger than yourself. And that, it can be quite simple, actually. I really like Bantu. It always brings us back to sort of simple, practical notions. And he says, for example, to the extent that you think of others with genuine concern, you're being non-egoistic. Yeah? So to the extent you think of others with genuine concern, you're kind of off the wheel a bit. Yeah, you're off the wheel a bit. So, but what we're trying to do is get completely off the wheel. So we can have tastes of being on that spiral, but usually we end up kind of it's got very strong gravitational force and it pulls us back down again. So what can happen is even if we have quite long times of feeling inspired or quite strong impulses of metta, which we have got, it's like they're on a bit of a string or a peg and we're sort of pulled back down onto the sort of the wheel motion again. It's sort of like that hub of the wheel, that greed, hatred and delusion eventually, sooner or later, appropriates that back again and pulls us back in while we're not completely free. And what we're trying to do in our Dharma life is create a momentum of that spiral that becomes so strong that the hub of that wheel can't pull us in anymore. And that's a point that's traditionally called stream entry. It's changing the metaphor a bit to call it entering the stream. But there comes a point on that spiral where you've sort of been pulled the other way. You've been pulled towards enlightenment, towards the Buddha, more strongly than you've been pulled into just circling around the sort of the egoistic sense. And that's what we're aiming at. So that's what the Dharma says is possible. That if we keep practicing in this non-egoistic way, if we keep letting something other than ourselves, something greater than ourselves, be at the centre, and we keep doing that, we'll sort of build up a momentum that eventually becomes irreversible and we can't be pulled back down into the clutches of that monster anymore. And you could say that that's what practice is. I think the metaphor of gravity is quite good, actually. I was trying to remember my physics, that centripetal and centrifugal force, but anyway, I couldn't remember it. But something about the wheel is sucking us in. But there's something else, our impulses towards something greater, also at exerting a force. So we are trying to be more and more open to the force that's pulling us the other way. And the more we practice, the more kind of, the more of a kind of clear conscience through ethical practice we've got, the more the force of enlightenment can affect us, And that can start pulling us the other way, as it were. I'm kind of speaking in metaphors here. So that gravitational force becomes greater and we can't be sucked down anymore. So that's a sort of, that's a metaphorical way of talking about what our Dharma life can be like. We're trying to get off the wheel. That means, I mean, when I say off the wheel, it's not the wheel exists outside us. I simply mean we're trying to get out of this mode of just reacting, the knee-jerk reaction, the habits that dig more and more ruts, just going round and round. We're trying to free ourselves from that and operate in a more spiral mode that can become more and more strong until that becomes the dominant force, until there's no kind of the wheel can't exert its pull on us anymore. Okay, so if you've got any questions about that, you have to ask me after tea, because we're going to go and have tea now. And don't forget, if you've got one of these pictures, bring it in with you after tea. If you've not got one, I'll just leave a couple of piles at the front here and just take one, and hopefully there's enough to go around. Okay, so was there any questions or responses to what was in before the tea break about these two modes of being, the sort of creative mind and reactive mind, the wheel and the spiral? Does that feel true to people's experience? The sort of, they say the wheel, does the wheel feel true? Do people recognise that sort of reactive, yeah, going round and round, yeah. And how about the spiral? Do people have any sense of that?
The feeling or the experience of having been on the wheel seems to have two aspects to it, or I can think of it in two ways. When you say mind reactive and mind creative, definitely those experiences of just an instantaneous reaction where there's some sort of stimulus and I'm involved in a situation and there's a response.
Yeah.
But also that experience of going round in circles, of digging ruts, feels very familiar. But somehow the spiral, I like the way the spiral still involves being in the situation, or being in familiar situations, possibly. But somehow there's an element of recognition of, oh, I've been here before. It's not just these people aren't creating this form. This feels familiar. Oh, I'm here again.
And I think that recognition is perspective, actually, isn't it? And I think, well, as I said before, that's what our Dharma practice, that's one way you can look at what we're trying to, why we practice the Dharma, is first of all to get that perspective. You could even say an aspect of enlightenment is having an absolute panoramic perspective. And I was thinking even a simple practice like the mindfulness of breathing, like having that perspective is a kind of deeper, it's a deeper dimension of mindfulness. We've got the sort of basic dimension of mindfulness that we often talk about, just, being in our moment-to-moment experience, which might see as a practice that helps us to feel calmer, to be more collected, to be more integrated. But I think also, like mindfulness has got that quality of, that watchfulness for that moment of choice, isn't it? It's interesting you said instantaneous. That's what it feels like, instantaneous. And I don't know where I got this from, but I'm sure I read somewhere that is 1/16th of a finger snap you've got in terms of time between the stimulus happening and you reacting. And I sometimes think, meditation and mindfulness are trying to, it's almost like extend the length of that gap. So you realise actually it's not instantaneous. There is a possibility of choice. And I think it works both ways. It's almost like there's the moment to moment, and then there's the, like, oh, here I am again. Like, how did I end up? We often find it in relationships, don't we? Oh, how did I end up in this type of relationship again? Or how did I end up kind of, I don't know, married to my mother or father or something, you know, that kind of thing. And you think, oh, how did this happen again, you know? And then you realise, well, I must be an agent in this, yeah. So I find that very useful. I mean, it's the terms mind react and mind creative are, they've been coined by Sangharakshita. They're not traditional terms, although they come from the tradition. But I think that's one of the key kind of teachings he's given to us. Just very, very simple way to, and practical way to remember these modes of being. It comes from, particular lecture he gave. You can find it on Free Buddhist Audio if you're interested. Mind react and mind creative. Just, fantastic way of describing this wheel and the spiral. So that's it. So that's the general thing about the wheel. What we're looking at over the last week and this week and next week is the section. There's four concentric circles on your picture. So we're looking at the third of these four. We're looking at what we call the six realms. Yeah. So there's six different realms. And you can look at these, as Nyanavacha said last week, as actually existing realms, or you can look at each of them as states of our psyche, yeah? And probably I find it most useful to look at it in terms of states of mind that we inhabit. And the realms are, we're doing two per week, so at the top you've got the hell realm, and at the top you've got the heaven realm, and at the bottom you've got the hell realm. There's also the realm of animals and humans, which we'll be doing exploring next week. And then tonight we're going to be exploring the realm of the hungry ghosts and the realm of the jealous gods. And most of these realms are realms of suffering. Most of these realms are unhappy realms where suffering predominates. And in terms of our psychological, you can see them as kind of psychological projections, the projections of our unenlightened consciousness, of our consciousness that's dominated by greed and hatred and delusion. They're kind of blind alleys that we're kind of tragic creatures, really. We all want happiness, we all want freedom, but yet we go up these blind alleys trying to find that. That's the sort of tragedy. And we go up these blind alleys, and then we kind of produce for ourselves the sort of concrete realizations of that state of mind that's kind of driven by craving and hatred and delusion. And that creates these realms, as I say, most of which are realms of suffering. Another important thing though about all these realms is, and we certainly mentioned this last week, but it's good to reiterate, is that none of them are permanent. So that it's all kind of permeable. We can move both from one realm to another, but also we can move out of these realms completely when we start on the spiral path. So I'll just in a sentence or two recap on the ones from last week. So last week we had the hell realm, that's at the bottom, and that's all the torture. That's a sort of very tortured state. And you could say that the hell realm is the objectification of hatred. And it's hatred that's hardened into a habitual mood. And it kind of creates a realm. I mean, when we do it, we know ourselves, you know, when you're in that mood of hatred, everything just looks ugly, doesn't it? Everything, you feel paranoid, you feel like people are talking about you, you feel da-da-da, so you're objectifying your own ill will, yeah, in the hell realm, as a psychological state. And then the God realm, in a way the God realm is a realm that isn't characterised by suffering. It's one of the couple that aren't characterised completely by suffering. It's characterised by pleasure, even quite refined pleasure. And you could say it's the objectification of a consciousness that's quite ethical, that's quite able to respond to values like goodness and truth and beauty. But it's not enlightenment, yeah. The God realm isn't enlightenment, because it's still within this, it's still within the wheel of life, and it will come to an end. I get this sometimes after a retreat, actually. I get a sort of complacency after a retreat. I can go on retreat and I can really engage with meditation and really, throw myself into it. And then for the couple of days when I come back from retreat, I can often feel really great. And like, that's like the God realm in a way. It's the fruits of practice. But then I often trip myself up, because I get into a bit of pride and I think, oh, look at me, like I'm great, I'm really happy, I'm really well. And I forget to practice. I forget that I somehow think, well, this is me, you know, I've kind of made it somehow, and this'll last forever. I forget that actually it's because I made an effort that I'm in this positive state, and I kind of get lazy about making the effort. And of course, what happens is, before I know it, I've kind of, you know, snapped at somebody and got in an argument, and everything just crumbles. You know, it is that tears before bedtime thing. Everything just quite quickly crumbles. And that's the danger of the God realm. There's the danger of complacency. There's the danger of, it's a sort of spiritual cul-de-sac, Bhante calls it sometimes. It's a valuable one. He doesn't sort of dismiss the God realm. He says, well, you need those experiences of the fruits of practice. That's what can kind of keep us going. But just don't make the mistake of getting attached to that and thinking this is it. I think you get that in the life story of the Buddha as well. When he first goes forth from home into the homeless life, he meets two meditation teachers, and they teach him all they know about meditation, and he attains very, very refined, very positive, blissful states of mind. But luckily for us, he knows that isn't it. He knows he's not enlightened, you know, so, and he moves on from those teachers. He doesn't, you know, he could just almost kind of settle down in this kind of happy, blissful state, you know, but he knows it's not enlightenment. So neither heaven or hell in Buddhist terms are permanent states, and there's certainly no, you don't end up in the hell realm as a punishment or the heaven realm as a reward. They're simply objectifications of our own mental states and projections. We end up there as a natural result of how we conduct ourselves and the thoughts we think in our mind. In each of those realms, in all the realms, there's a Buddha figure. And in the hell realm, the Buddha is bringing ambrosia, which is the nectar of immortality. And in the heaven realm, the Buddha is playing the lute of impermanence. So he's reminding those beings in a way that they can respond to, that this will not last forever. Okay, so now we're going to look at the realm of the hungry ghost. So that is the realm. So that's this one. It's on the, if you go round clockwise, it's the bottom right hand side. So what do you see if you look in that realm? How would you describe these creatures in this realm?
They're fairly wretched.
They're fairly wretched, yeah. And can you see the form the wretchedness is taking?
They're starving.
They're starving, who said that? Yeah, they're starving. Yeah, how do you know they're starving?
Well, they sort of remind me of starving African children in the loads of bellies and that, you know, they don't look happy. They're not sort of jolly and fun.
So they're starving. So they've got these huge bellies. So how they're depicted is they've got these huge bellies that can never be filled. And also their mouths are meant to be really, really tiny, so they can never get enough to satisfy them. And not only that, do you see that one with all the sort of sores in its belly? Anything they do eat turns into sores that start sort of sticking out of their belly. So, you know, so this sort of, whatever they do manage to get into these tiny mouths ends up causing them more torment and pain than the desire did in the first place. So very, very tortured realm indeed. Very, very tortured realm. So can people reckon, if we think of that realm as a psychological state of being, can people sort of recognise that state?
Mm-hmm. I can imagine strong feelings of jealousy are equivalent to that.
That sort of torture of jealousy.
That's the only thing I can really think of.
And what about this kind of the trying to fill yourself with something that causes you pain? Do people
get out of biscuits?
That's a good example. So say more about the biscuits, honey.
It's like, a bit hungry, come home from work, a bit stressed, tired, eating one biscuit, and I'll already be having the other biscuit in my hand. And the biscuit's in my mouth already. You know, it's not satisfying me, but I think another one will do it. I'm eating, if that happened today at lunchtime as well.
Bloated and swollen stomach.
But I think that's a brilliant definition of craving, isn't it? That you, or not even definition, experience of craving. That you want another one of this, even though I haven't finished the first one yet. Mm-hmm. A friend said that was when he finally stopped smoking, when he realised that he hadn't even finished. He was already thinking of the next cigarette while he was still smoking the one he was on. Yeah. And actually, it's never going to work, is it? Because we're already eating the biscuit or smoking the cigarette. So that's the state of the hungry ghost. I'll come back to jealousy later, and jealousy might come in even more with the other realm we're going to visit tonight. But it's a state of craving. So I'm going to, I'm using this book. It's not in print anymore, I don't think, but if you ever see it secondhand, The Buddha's Vision by Subhuti. I want to tell you a few things he says, and then we can have a bit of a discussion about it. It's a bit following on from what Adam says. So he says, well, it is like a kind of hell, this world of the hungry ghosts. And you can see that even the way it's sort of depicted. It's a kind of hell. And the pain in this kind of hell is the pain of unsatisfied desire. So Subhuti says that just as hell is the objectification of hatred, this realm is the reflection of our mind that craving predominates. So what is craving? I mean, we've had a good description of it from Adam, but what is craving? If I was to just say, who could give me a sentence that describes craving?
I want more.
I want more, yeah. And why do you want more?
Because you're not satisfied.
Okay.
Maybe you're imagining that it's something that it isn't.
Okay, yeah. So say, can you say more about that?
Well, sometimes I crave McDonald's. And it's really a strong feeling. And then when I eat it, I feel really horrible.
Okay.
It's the majority sugar.
I think that's it, and it's interesting. I mean, actually, food's the obvious one, like biscuits and McDonald's or something. But I think We can do it with so many things, can't we? And I think that's a good... Yeah, we want more. We're not satisfied. But and most... And then the third thing is we think that thing is going to give us... We think it's got more power to satisfy us than it's actually got. I think that's what distinguishes what you might call neurotic craving from healthy desire. Because, you know, we do have to eat, you know, and even eating a biscuit could be not out of craving. But I think it's craving when we think it's going to give us more than it is capable of giving us. You know, I noticed, Adam, when you talked about the biscuit, you said, oh, you felt a bit stressed and tired. So you know, we like foods when we're hungry, and even a biscuit might be more, but it's like we think it's going to make us feel better somehow, don't
but
we?
You nearly know already that it's not going to make you feel better. So there's some conflict because you know, rationally it doesn't make sense yet.
Yeah. It's interesting that as well, isn't it? Yeah, you can know in the very act of doing, well, we know rationally, but something in us is driving us that's stronger than the rational, isn't it? In a way, that's another good reason why we've got these symbols and why the whole Tibetan and Vajra tradition emphasizes symbols, because our rational mind does not govern us. You know, we're governed by something much more basic and gut level, and the symbols are trying to, you could say, convert those drives into something more wholesome. I think, we're not trying to sort of cut off or squash those parts of ourselves. In a way, it's okay to want to be happy and want to be fulfilled. But what we constantly do is we look and the very place where we actually, we know that won't give us that true satisfaction. So what Subhuti says is he says that craving is the longing to possess things in the belief that they will make our sense of ourselves more secure. And he says underlying this is a feeling of inner emptiness and insubstantiality. So, yeah. So what we'll do is we'll kind of crave certain experiences and things, because that gives us a temporary relief, doesn't it? Very, very, for a fleeting moment, it's like the experience of whatever, the biscuit, the cigarette, the McDonald's, all that sort of absorbs consciousness, and we kind of get the illusion that just for a fleeting moment that we're fulfilled, but it just doesn't last, does it? And I think it's very, very graphic, isn't it, that it turns to knives in our bellies, actually. Because that's the nature of it as well. We need more, you know, with that neurotic craving, we're always going to need more. We're always going to need the next one before we finish the first one. Yes. Can you think of any other things?
It's an absence of peace.
What's that, sorry?
I think it's an absence of peace.
An absence of peace, yes, Caroline, yeah.
Because I think when I'm on retreat...
Ah, yeah.
When I'm in those conditions...
Yeah.
Then I've got a sense of really settling down.
That's right.
So I'm not constantly thinking about being outside myself.
Yeah.
And as soon as I come out of that situation, all of that stuff starts kicking off about, oh, I have this job, that whole, and it's because I've lost that sense of just being peaceful.
Yeah. I think that's very, very interesting, isn't it? And it's almost like you could say what comes first, so the sense of peace. Because the sense of peace isn't an absence, is it? It's a richness. Our inner life on retreat becomes richer. And then that's genuinely satisfying, isn't it? And I think that's important because, again, it's not a sort of puritanical thing that we're saying that we mustn't have biscuits or nice things. It's like actually saying we need to have things that truly nourish us. And I think on retreat, that sort of simple life, within that we can find we can find such pleasure in such simple things on retreat, can't we? You know, such, you know, when you slow everything down, you know, the taste of a simple meal or just, you know, on my last retreat it was sunny, you know, one of the first days of spring, and I was just lying on my back looking at the blue sky and the, you know, the willow, you know, moving in the wind. It was so, you know, so satisfying. But yeah, I hardly ever take time to do that when you're rushing around with the world of emails and everything. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that peace and contentment is, that's like the positive counterpart of that, of craving. And I think it's important because we do need pleasure and fulfillment. And that's a healthy human need, but what we're doing is we're always looking in the wrong place for it. Yeah. What else do we, what else, how, what other things become objects of our more neurotic craving? Yes.
I think quite a common one is the kind of compulsion to pick out flaws in other people.
I think
I often do that without thinking as a kind of means to strengthen my sense of self. I'm right and they're wrong because I'm pointing out their flaws.
Yeah.
And actually it does leave you feeling, if you actually think, right, how do I feel now that I've smacked this person off? You don't feel fulfilled, you feel kind of empty.
Yeah.
And in a possibly more of an egotistical sense, you kind of let yourself down. I think that is a strong compulsion. I think in a way you could see that as a craving to kind of justify yourself all the time.
Yeah, it does. I think it ties in with what you said earlier about sort of jealousy. And I think that's true. We'll cut in a minute when we come on to these jealous gods, we'll come on to that even more. But I think it is, it's a kind of compulsion, isn't it? Yeah.
Love and relationship.
Ah, yes. Aha. Same word. Yeah.
That whole thing of craving the feeling that you can get from someone else.
Yeah.
And, you know, not being enough on your own. And then you get that someone else and it doesn't quite give you the feeling that you're after, and it's quite cyclical as well, so you crave it even more, and then you get it and it's like, oh, this isn't right, okay, let's have some more. And you just keep going on in this horrible vicious circle.
Yeah.
I think that's really true, like with long term relationships that you get to, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, and then you start to crave falling in love again, like when you're first dating, and you love your partner, and you're not going to go anywhere else. Like he's your dude that's hanging around the flat, sort of thing. you still crave, you know, him to say, right, I'm going to whisk you off to Paris like our first anniversary or something. And it's like, it's not going to happen, but you still sort of want to rekindle those first wooing days or what have you.
And it can happen both, can't it? Probably having a longer term relationships, but also can happen if you're like single and you kind of think you'll only be happy if you can have, you know, it's only, so what, okay, so are we saying relationships are bad and wrong and evil? So what's the difference between, what's the difference between a sort of neurotic craving and a kind of healthy relationship or a healthy state of being single, if that's what we're in?
It's independence, because I think where a lot of people go wrong, and to be honest, I saw this with my own parents' marriage, like when one person expects the other person to give them everything, all nourishment in terms of emotional, mental, physical, the whole thing, and it's like, you can't, you know, your husband or your wife can't do that for you. They might be able to fill you up 50%. You are responsible as your own being for nourishing yourself in other ways.
Yeah.
And it's not to criticise, you know, it happens over time, you become more mutually dependent over time.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of tune in with yourself and watch it and be like, right, I'm going to go to the Buddhist Centre on Monday night because that's my thing. And that's my self-nourishing thing.
And it's interesting because paradoxically, that often means you've got more to then give that relationship if you're in one. You know, it's... Yeah, I think that is the key to it. I think you've said a few really important things. That thing about looking for everything from one person. Because I think there's two aspects of that. One is Well, that's why we, certainly in this cycle, we like so emphasise spiritual friendship. We so emphasise, in a sense, not putting all your eggs in the one basket of a relationship if you're in one, which our culture is very predominantly saying. That actually, yeah, different people sort of meet different aspects of ourselves, and also that becoming more of a sort of true individual ourselves, so that you're meeting someone not out of an inner poverty, not out of a kind of please kind of fill me up, please make me feel special, and please make, you know, actually you're, you know, you can say the metta bhavana, especially the first stage, is so that it's that thing that the more we can feel nourished by our own inner richness, the more we can meet that other person. Well, actually, whether we're in a relationship, it's not even just relationships that this is happens with, doesn't it? It can happen in friendships, it can happen in, you know, with people we look up to and so on. We can so easily want them to affirm us, to tell us we're okay as a person, but actually we can only do that for ourselves. And then paradoxically, then it's almost like it's almost then easier for other people to respond to us. You know, where, you know, I know myself, if I'm in a very sort of needy mode, it just puts people off, doesn't it? And it's very, very difficult for them to give me what I need. Whereas if I'm feeling relatively okay, you know, then I can notice people will, yeah, will be able to affirm and respond. It's not that affirmation is wrong. We need that as well, but it's coming from that more healthy basis.
It's like giving the responsibility to someone else.
Yes.
Instead of taking responsibility for yourself and loving yourself, you expect someone else to do it for you.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it, isn't it? Yeah.
Eckhart Tolle said something in a book that really just completely made me think from the He said that you should try to see your relationship as the spiritual practice in itself, because it's such a challenging thing anyway. Instead of thinking, what can they do for me? How can they make me feel?
Yeah.
I want to feel more loved, but I want them to respect me. I want them to think I'm right. Or whatever.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, recognise those things are kind of, I suppose, ego-driven ideas, and use it as a spiritual practice. So do nice things for them. And well, I wouldn't know exactly how you would do it, because I think it's the idea of actually seeing it as a challenge. And treating it as spiritual practice,
as
opposed to just an external thing that can do something to you.
Yeah. Well, it is, and I think it boils down to, like, to what extent do we see, they're seeing ourselves, become more individual ourselves, but also they're seeing other people as people, rather than sort of somehow that they're, in some way we're reducing them, however subtly, to whatever we can get from them. And I think we can do it strongly in relationships, but we can do it with other people as well, you know. Very kind of, probably we don't do it in gross ways, although we might, but even in subtle ways we can, you know, we can almost kind of pigeonhole people and kind of think, oh yeah, well that's really nice hanging out with her because she's like a great laugh or something, but then, you know, maybe they don't feel like being a great laugh, but, you know, it's like allowing them to be them. And I think that's, again, like Bhante makes the distinction between group values, where we're trying to pigeonhole people and keep everything, keep the status quo, and encouraging each other to be an individual, even if that means we might, in some ways, lose out, but not in a deeper way we won't lose out, you know. They give people the freedom, basically, to be them, not try and make them into what we think they should be.
I'd love to hear your response to this, because to my knowledge, the Buddha only said one thing about relationships that might have meant romantic relationships, but it wasn't specified, and maybe you might know something else, but the one thing I have quite good authority from a teacher I had. He knew his stuff. He said that the Buddha said, if you want to live with somebody, you've got to have similar views. Which
to start with might sound like not that deep, but I've been in lots of conversations. I've often had people sort of at my place, you know, telling me all their worries about relationships and so on, and often it strikes me that there's actually quite a lot in there. You know? And I thought it was really quite mind-boggling. It doesn't say you have the same views, but you've probably got to have similar views. And I don't, apparently this is from the Pali Canon, I don't know. But
what's why Christians, my Christians, Muslims, my Muslims, Buddhists, potentially my Buddhists, it's,
yeah.
You know, you won't necessarily have one Christian with the same view as another Christian, but if you agree on stuff like how to bring up children, whether or not you should get married, and whether or not you would agree with the rules, which are fairly big, make or break deal breakers, then you've got a good basis for living together. And things like whether or not you eat pork, whether or not you eat halal meat, all those kind of, because that's like an everyday, or whether or not you're vegetarian, for example.
Yeah.
You know, you might be a vegetarian and a partner that eats meat, and there's nothing like sort of coming home to a lamb steak being sat in a tray, and you're like, that makes me feel really ill. And are you prepared to accept that because you love the partner, or are you? Like you're not.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think you're completely right. You know, it helps remove the niggles, and actually, love is doing the dishes.
Maybe I'll draw in a little bit from talking just exclusively about relationships. I'm not sure. I've never heard that the Buddha said that, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to have it verified. You know,
well, I mean, I think probably maybe I think kind of like coming back, I would definitely. I think we could bring it back to whether it's a sort of romantic, sexual, partnership, relationship, or actually, you know, there's all sorts of different types of relationship as well, but I think I'd bring it back to we're neurotic to the extent that we want, you know, we want more from that person than they have the power to give us. And it's healthy to the extent that we can find fulfillment in ourselves and allow them to be a person in their own right. Yeah? So I think I'd come back to that, yeah. Let's have one more on this subject. Are you going to say something? Oh, hang on, I think we've got someone here, and then we'll have you, and then we'll move us on to the other realm.
I was just going to add to what you said about this whole neurotic behaviour that we have. I think that the more that we expect from that person and the less that we get it, I think that probably relates to that picture where it's stabbing yourself with those knives, because you're getting more and more frustrated because you're still not getting that from that person.
Yeah.
You know, it's still not happening.
Yeah.
You're not changing. And maybe it's best not to have those expectations.
But I think you're right in a way. I think in some ways, I think we can't expect anyone to do anything. We can only work on ourselves, actually, can't we? Yeah, let's have one more.
One of the cravings I was going to say is attention. I think people like crave quite a lot. It's something you kind of talked about so early.
Yeah.
But I definitely like kind of noticed in my family. Members will really like want to get attention, and if they can't get it from positive means, then they'll start doing things which are more kind of destructive, just to kind of be the focus of the drama. It's really quite horrible because I'm sure they're not even kind of that conscious of what's going on.
Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? And I think that's a tragedy that we do it unconsciously. And again, it's like, in a sense, there's. I think the sort of wish to be loved and the wish to be fulfilled in life, that's not wrong in itself. It's that we do these unconscious, we've got these unconscious strategies that don't work. Actually, they put other people off, it's a kind of, it's a bit like the biscuits, you know, the more you have, the more you want, you know, you'll never be able to get enough, you know. You'll never be able to get enough. So you need to start attending to those needs in the correct way. So what do you think the Buddha, what do you think the Buddha brings in the realm of the Buddha brings something to them. What does he bring to them in this realm? You can't quite see it. can't quite say. So what he brings is he simply brings food and drink that they can eat, yeah? That won't turn into knives in their stomachs. So he brings something that's genuinely nourishing. So we haven't got time now probably to go into what that might be, but that might be worth pondering on. When we're in that state of craving, we need to think what would be genuinely nourishing in this state. That's probably quite a good question to ask ourselves the next time we're kind of thinking, oh well, I just need a little reward here, or I need a little, you know, what would actually be genuinely nourishing? Yeah, and that's what the Buddha brings. And it's very, very compassionate, isn't it? Because the Buddha's not saying, you're bad, you're wrong for having this craving. The Buddha's saying, okay, yeah, here's something that actually will nourish you. So that's the realm of the hungry ghosts. So I want to make sure we've got time to look at the other realm. So the realm above the hungry ghosts, this is the realm, the Buddhist word for it is the asuras, and that translates variously as the anti-gods, jealous gods, or angry gods. So what do you notice about them? Or well, the name probably gives it away as well. What they're all carrying.
Weapons,
yeah. So they're all carrying weapons.
Are they jealous of each other, or just jealous of everything?
Jealous of everything. Jealous of everything, yeah. And I think this ties in with what you were talking about. I'll just read you what the Buddha says, because it's almost the same as what you were saying. He says, they're called gods because they're godlike in their power. They've got a lot of power and vigour, but they're not godlike in happiness and pleasure. And they're driven by envy. So that ties in with what you were saying earlier, envy and jealousy. So they also long to possess, but unlike the hungry ghosts, which came from desire and greed, they want things because they begrudge others whatever possessions, achievements, or qualities they may have. The success of others makes them feel belittled, for their sense of self rests upon them being the centre of the universe. Does anybody recognise that state of being?
No.
Didn't think you did. So that's quite strong, isn't it? Jealousy. It's very irrational emotion, really, isn't it? Jealousy, when you think about it. Yeah, go on, Ethan.
You mentioned jealousy and envy.
Oh yeah.
Could you expand slightly on what they are and what the difference?
I've never been quite sure of the difference between envy and jealousy.
I've been told that envy is where you want something that someone else has, but you don't necessarily resent them for having it. So I might like your red jumper and think, oh, I'd like a red jumper.
Okay.
But I don't feel angry towards you.
Okay,
or
I see.
Resent you for having your red jumper, and I don't want to take it off and you can't have it. If I was jealous of you, like jealous that you had a red jumper, I resent that you had a red jumper,
okay,
and I'd be happy to take it off you and you
okay.
lose.
Yeah. Okay, now that's like a So jealousy has got a very strong element of ill will. Like, I remember somebody once said to me when I was in the throes of jealousy that it's probably one of our most negative emotions because it combines craving and hatred in the one thing, and it's completely irrational, isn't it? But yeah, we still do it. Well, it's delusional because also it's sort of, well, actually, maybe not the case in red jumpers balls, because I was going to say, because it's sort of the delusion that there's only so much kind of love to go round, for example. We often feel it in relation to relationships and love and stuff. It's like if somebody else has got it, I won't be able to have it. So there's a sort of delusion that there's only so much happiness or love to go round. These are sort of immeasurable quantities.
I
think it's something that you see a lot in work as well. It's like, like there's only so much credit to go around. There's only one person who's going to get the credit.
That's competitiveness. I think there can be a healthy competitiveness and an unhealthy competitiveness. I think the unhealthy one is when you actually will, but like with jealousy, you'd be prepared to actually do down the other person. You know, I think there can be a healthy competitiveness where you just, you know, you want to, you spur each other on and you bring out the best in a way. But I think where the ill will comes in, where you actually would, you do anything, you don't care. It's a kind of very harsh sort of thing, isn't it?
I think it's very linked to your sense of self, though, that kind of unhealthy, negative jealousy is.
Yeah.
You know, if they've achieved something, in your mind, it means that you have not achieved something. So you, it means that there's something wrong with you because they've achieved something, which is a ridiculous kind of assumption to make through. But that is what I think kind of that toxic jealousy is what comes about you.
Yeah.
It's a negative perception, isn't it?
I think it's linked to comparing yourself to other people. And I think we kind of feel like we have to constantly measure ourselves against other people. But yeah, in a way it means you can't purely feel happiness for somebody else.
Does anybody know what the quality of feeling happiness for somebody else is called in Buddhism?
That's a
compulsion. I didn't hear or see where the voice came from.
Was it compersion?
Compassion's usually when...
Compersion. Feeling happiness that someone else is happy. Another person is happy. And you feel good because they're happy.
Okay.
It's very...
So what was that word? I've never heard that word before.
Compersion. C-O-N-P-E-R-S-I-N.
Oh, is that an English word?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good new word. Compersion. Okay, so there's an equivalent Buddhist word for compersion. Does anyone know what that is? Mudita. Yes, there's the word mudita, which is, it's what happens when metta encounters someone who's had good fortune or success. Then there's mudita or compersion, which is the opposite. Envy is the opposite, and jealousy is even more the opposite. Yes.
I think somehow that idea of sharing with somebody else's happiness is expansive, and it's a kind of empathy or connection, whereas I think when you're reducing somebody to something that they have which you don't, it's again shutting yourself off from really knowing them.
It is, isn't it? It's a very strong barrier, And actually, I think that barrier is quite, I think that's quite strong for these jealous gods. There's a sort of ruthlessness and there's a barrier. I'll just tell you something else about Buddhism, which might be as interesting. He says that the beings, and he says that it's also a realm of extreme sexual polarity. So I thought that was quite interesting. He says you've got he calls them like titans, like in the Greek, and titanesses. And he says that neither extreme is kind of redeemed by the qualities of the other. So he says in this realm, femininity in a man or masculinity in a woman would be considered like totally shameful and sort of no-go. It's sort of exaggeratedly, one-sidedly, kind of sexually polarized. So you've got that kind of, you've got the male titans or male kind of archers would be like totally aggressive, sort of is into establishing dominance through aggression, and the females would be sort of using a kind of sexual allure to weave a sort of control, and neither would be sort of redeemed by the other. So you've got a kind of this realm of very, very strong polarisation like that.
Sounds
I don't know
like
what
sales team.
Was that? But sometimes we do end up sort of doing that, don't we? Yeah. So it's quite
People flip the director in the
So that's quite striking, isn't it? Whereas I suppose a kind of a more healthy psyche, whether you're a man or a woman, is trying to integrate the masculine and feminine, and is trying to have both kind of operational, isn't sort of strongly, isn't kind of using that aspect of herself for dominance, whether in the brute force way or that kind of more. I thought it was interesting with the kind of more manipulative, sort of seductive way, that's also, although you most of what you can see here is the sort of sword, so that realm would also include trying to manipulate and so on, and just it's sort of power mode. Bhante talks about, another way Bhante talks, another sort of phrase he's coined is the power mode versus the love mode. So he says more and more as Dharma practitioners, we're learning to operate in the love mode, where you're coming from a basis of metta. And he says, particularly in the spiritual community, we're trying more and more to operate in the love mode. Whereas the power mode is seeking dominance all the time. It's trying to get, if you're operating in the power mode, is when you're trying to get somebody to do something by whatever means that they don't want to do. So you're either trying to do it through brute force, or you're trying to coerce or manipulate them. Because you want it for your own ends. Yeah. And that can be quite gross, it can be quite subtle. So anytime that we're trying to kind of get our own way in any form, we're in the power mode realm of the asuras. So what do you notice that the Buddha's bringing? What's the Buddha bringing to the asura realm?
The sword.
The sword. So that's interesting, isn't it? So why do you think he's bringing a sword, and what do you think it means?
Fight violence and violence?
That's a violence, yeah. What's that, sorry?
Trying to cut it, metaphorically, cut it out.
So it's cutting through something metaphorically, yeah. Oh.
Maybe it's like the other one where he's bringing food that they can eat.
Yeah.
Maybe he's bringing a certain kind of, you don't call it a weapon, but a certain kind of way of influencing.
Yeah.
That's actually more fulfilling and more...
Yeah. I think that's it. I think whatever he said, right, he's kind of bringing something that they can recognise and influence. So for example, what would happen in the God realm, the Buddha brings the lute. What do you think would happen if a Buddha turned up with a lute in the Ashura realm?
His strings would get broken.
Yeah. It's true, it's a wrong symbol. That's why the power of symbols is quite strong, isn't it? It's the wrong symbol. He's got to bring something that they are actually going to, well, respect and relate to. And I think it's quite interesting as well to see that, well, some Buddha figures do wield a sword. We're used to thinking of, sometimes we think of Buddhism as all gentle, sitting under a tree, and although, but actually the Buddha is also powerful. The Buddha can wield a sword, but of course he won't use the sword to destroy people, but it's traditionally said that he uses the sword to kind of cut through wrong views, to cut through ignorance, yeah? But it is a sword, very kind of, often it's said to be a very sharp sword that can kind of like just cut a silk scarf thrown up into the air. So, and it's also, it's interesting, that's what, if your predominant mode is competitiveness and kind of warrior-like, actually what Buddhism is saying is, Buddhism isn't asking you to then turn into this kind of sweet butter would melt in my mouth sort of person. It's saying use that energy, but use it for the Dharma. I really love that about the Dharma practice, and especially these Vajrayanic symbols and tantric symbols, that what you're doing is transforming. You're taking the raw energy, you're taking your sort of crude energy of competitiveness and jealousy, but you're actually saying you can use that energy, you sort of sublimate it for the power of the good, but you can kind of capture the energy rather than any notion that you've got to either cut off that part of yourself or sort of turn into a totally different personality that you're just sort of not, in a sense. But you direct it, you direct it in a positive way. So I think that symbol of the sword, I think the sword is a real genuine symbol actually, because it's got all those meanings. It's quite, it's got those multi-valent meanings.
Could it be slightly literal? Maybe the simplest way to put it is I did used to be a teacher, and when you've got a lot of sort of teenage boys sort of really being uber masculine, you sort of, if you're going to get through to them, you've kind of got to man up a bit. Not gentle person, but you sort of got to, because otherwise they're not going to listen.
Well, I think that's it, isn't it? Yeah, it is. Well, the thing about it, I think it's that similar principle on a kind of, you know, raised up to a level of the Buddha. It's just that psychological, it's just that.
It's talking their language, isn't it?
Yeah, it's talking their language, And also we can, you see, again, we can think of this as a literal the Buddha coming, but also it's like, you know, what we're trying to do is integrate that Buddha figure into ourselves. So if we're finding ourselves in a state of competitiveness and jealousy and so on, you can't instantly go from that to that mudita thing, usually. You need to find sort of stepping stones on the way. So like a stepping stone can be, okay, well I can, it's almost like, who is the Buddha within, you know, can I bring that sword of wisdom myself, you know? What was my next step? And so I just find that quite a useful practical teaching. So just as when you find yourself in that realm of the hungry ghosts, you think, oh, what would truly nourish me? When you find yourself in that realm of the asuras, you think, oh, how can I turn this energy to the good? Yeah. So it's like meeting yourself. You're the ashra, but also you're trying to become the Buddha as well for yourself. So, you don't need to wait for a Buddha to appear, actually. You can just ask yourself, well, what would that sword mean for me just now? How can I use that energy to actually sort of break through? So you could, maybe you could use the sword to cut through all the wrong views. Jealousy depends on all these wrong views. Can I slash through those wrong views, for example?
It just strikes me if somebody's a very gentle person, and you need to communicate, you kind of have to be gentle with them.
Yeah, exactly.
If someone's being a bit more you sort of have to kind of sort of slightly get in step with that.
Yeah,
so
I'm
just wondering if that's if you think this wheel is kind of with these little Buddhas kind of almost adapting himself.
It's the same principle, but on the level of Buddha. And in a way that just, and we'll need to sort of wind up here now, but that's, in a way that's something, I feel rejoicing at in the Dharma, that the Buddha, as it were, won't just appear in one way. And that's why we've got all these different archetypal forms of the Buddha, because different ones will be appropriate at different time, and that's why we might respond to one form of the Buddha carrying a sword, or we might respond to a form of the Buddha carrying the nectar of immortality and so on. And if we do find ourselves responding to, say, that symbol of the sword, then we can explore that within ourselves. Or maybe that doesn't really touch us in any way and another one does. Explore that, even if we don't quite know why, because meanings can unfold. Yeah? So, but anyway, we're going to have to leave it there. But next week, I'm going to be talking about the realm of the animals and the human beings. And also I'm going to be bringing in another teaching that applies to all the realms, which is called Buddha Seeds. Yeah, so I'll be telling you about that next week as well. So hope to see you then. So thank you.
Thank you.